Zach Afridi is a New York-based Pakistani-American artist who explores the dichotomy of being an insider-outsider.
I consider myself in many ways an insider-outsider, which is being comfortable in all places, feeling like an insider in all places, but then, you know, knowing that you are an outsider as well, or sometimes made to feel like that. And just sort of walking that balance is what it's all about. And if you're comfortable doing that, then that's sort of the sweet spot.
Through his work, he recreates the historical and cultural narratives to highlight social issues. He collaborates with weavers, painters, and food vendors to address the problems around identity, Islamophobia, and social justice.
If you look at Jackson Pollock, it's no different. You know, it's like, well, anybody could have painted that, or anybody could have thrown, or you have to understand context and you have to read the book with context. You can't just take a quote out and say, kill the infidels, because it's connected to a bunch of other things. And that's not what it's saying.
Some of these issues we've already talked about with so many other guests. So it will be very interesting to get Zach's perspective on these issues. Zach is in the studio with me to talk about a lot of these issues. This is Immigrantly, and I'm your host, Sadia Khan. Welcome, Zach. I'm so excited, and we are finally doing this, right?
Yeah.
So we rescheduled it twice.
I'm sorry about that.
In fact, three times.
Yes.
But one time it was because of me, and then it was because of your scheduling issues. So you are a lot busier than I am.
And I apologize for that. Yes, I am. I have a very hectic schedule because I have a full-time job, and then I have a full-time art practice, and then I have a full-time family. That's three full times. So that's three times I was late.
So
I had to reschedule.
You had to reschedule. And the good thing is you didn't cancel.
No,
yeah.
Of course not, because this is important.
Oh, thank you. Okay, let's start with your name. Your first name, Sax.
Saqib. Yeah.
I did this episode a few months back. It's called What's in a Name?
Yeah.
And it's about how immigrants change their names and make them more westernized or anglicized when they come to the U.S. to make it easier for other people to pronounce.
Easier to remember, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But then your last name is Afridi.
Damn proud of it.
Yes. Yeah. So I was going to ask you, it's like people who grew up in Pakistan or even Afghanistan know that it represents an ethnic identity. It represents a tribe. So I'm sure you're very proud of that. But how many times has that name been butchered?
Afridi is not. Saqib was butchered.
Really?
That's why I changed it.
Oh my God, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I haven't like legally changed it or anything. But I spelled it or spell it S-A-K-I-B. I was born with S-A-Q-I-B. And then at some point in middle school, I decided that I wanted it to be grammatically correct because there should be a U after a Q, so I changed it to S-A-Q-U-I-B, and that didn't work so well. And then I just moved it to S-A-K-I-B, and I was S-A-K-I-B for the longest time. And then here in the U.S., everybody would just call me Saqib, and that just got under my skin. And after about maybe 10 or so years of it just, or longer, of just getting under my skin, or people just having a hard time remembering it. I think that's what it was. I like to think of myself as a fairly memorable person. So when I would get people who I'd met a couple of times, you know, through work or whatever, they would look at me with like, hey, nice guy whose name I can't remember. And that would happen all the time. And I kind of just got sick of it. And as I was, you know, just one day, a friend of mine, Sophie Ali, says, why don't you just change it to Sax? It's simple. We have a friend, Shaquille, who's Shax. And she goes, you can just be Sax. And I thought, you know, that's a great idea. I'm just like really sick of it. And so the next day I changed my emails, my business cards, my social profiles, and nobody's forgotten my name since. So it was really a branding exercise. It's, you know, another way to say it, it's my stage name. And as an artist, I get to have a stage name.
It's interesting because, so I have two girls, and I have named them Palvasha and Zermina. extremely ethnic names.
Give your daughters hard names. Yeah, I get it. Listen, I'm all for it. I've definitely felt the guilt of changing it.
Although Zermina is easier to pronounce, nobody messes it up.
Yeah.
Palvasha is hard. Butchered
all the time. Yeah. Palvasha.
And she's like come up with all these different concoctions of it. And sometimes she doesn't even tell me what she's calling herself anymore. And to me, it boils down to why should we change our names? Why should the onus be on us rather than, you know, be on the people who need to learn our names? We learn Gora names, don't we?
Yeah, but it's a two-way street. And it's, you know, we're not the only ones who have done this. Ralph Lauren's name is Ralph Lifshitz. So the artist Rothko, his name is Rothkowitz. So, like, he changed his name because there were too many Jewish artists. So people do change their name sometimes for memorability, sometimes for branding, like in my case, but other times just to assimilate. I did not do it for assimilation in any way. I pretty well assimilated in wherever I am, whether it's in Pakistan or here or anywhere else. But there's a certain amount of guilt that goes with it. Charmin Obed-Chinoy is a friend, and she was always like, oh, what's with the Sax? What are you doing? What's with Sax? I'm just going to call you Saqib. I'm not going to call you Sax. And there's many people in Pakistan who refuse to call me Saqib, Sax. And that's cool. I'm both. I'm, you know, it's fluid.
Yeah, that's true. And I think for Pakistanis especially, it's more like a colonial hangover. We don't want...
Yes.
Because of our colonial history,
People think,
anti-colonialism in every form and way. Right. So even a name that reminds us of that, we will react.
Right. People think I did it to anglicize, but no, it's just like they were butchering it.
Yeah, it was pain in the ass.
And it was just a pain in the ass. Yeah, you haven't lived it. You don't know.
Yeah. Let's talk about your childhood. Your dad was in Pakistan International Airlines.
Yeah, and PIA.
PIA, right? And because of that, you traveled a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one place you still would like to call home, though? Because you've been a global citizen. You've lived in different places.
Yeah, I don't think we have to have one place to call home. I think that definition of home is, you know, speaking of fluidity, is also fluid. I have two homes. I have Pakistan as a home, and I have New York City as a home. New York City is not America. New York City is its own nationality. I have a sweatshirt that says New York is a nationality. And New York and Pakistan both. Don't consider either one more home or less home. They're kind of equal. Pakistan holds a much more special place because of emotionally. But New York is where my soul is.
And in Pakistan, where did you grow up?
So I grew up moving countries every 2 to 3 years.
Oh.
So I never really lived in one place for longer than that. So I'll just give you a quick chronology and then you'll know. I was born in Peshawar, like you.
I wasn't born in Peshawar. Oh, okay. I was born in Rawalpindi.
So, born in Peshawar, lived there for 5 years, then we moved to Libya for a year, then we moved to Sri Lanka for 3 years, then came back to Peshawar for 3 years, after which we went to Saudi Arabia for 3 years, then came back to Rawalpindi in Pakistan, and lived there for a year, and then moved to Islamabad for 2 years, and then we moved to Johannesburg for a couple of years, and then... Well, I lived there for a year. I came back to Pakistan for about 6-8 months or so to Rawalpindi. And then we moved to Dubai for about a year. And then I came to the U.S. for college. And then in the U.S., I lived in Connecticut, Philadelphia for a short stint. Like, I don't even, not really lived, just stayed there for a while. And New York City twice, San Francisco.
And how has that changed your outlook on life? Has it made you more tolerant of other cultures, religions, ethnicities?
100%. 100%. I feel I'm much more flexible and open person because of that. Because I was thrown into different cultures and school systems and social dynamics to deal with at a fairly young age and just... forced to adapt, it makes it easy, and that's why I have a series of works, and I consider myself in many ways an insider outsider, which is being comfortable in all places, feeling like an insider in all places, but then, you know, knowing that you are an outsider as well, or sometimes made to feel like that. And just sort of walking that balance is what it's all about. And if you're comfortable doing that, then that's sort of the sweet spot.
And does it also help in your marriage? Because you're married to a Palestinian American,
yes.
Different ethnic identity, different religious identity.
Same values.
So I interviewed Susie,
yeah.
Your wife.
Yes.
She's a comedian. Her episode was one of my favorite episodes. A, because I giggled throughout. I couldn't stop laughing. And one thing that I noticed about her was that she's a big fan of yours, by the way. She did not stop talking about you. And it piqued my curiosity about who you are, because she, like, I don't know if you've listened to, I'm sure you've listened to her episode.
Yes, I have.
And she talked about you constantly.
I talk about her constantly too.
Yeah, so
we're both each other's biggest PR machines.
So how does that work in your family? Because I remember she mentioned something like parenting styles, and she thought that as an Arab mom, her parenting style is very different from your mom's parenting style.
Mm-hmm.
And because
yeah.
Desi moms are a bit like crazy, maybe. And
mom's not crazy. She's just very disciplined and determined. And I think she did a fantastic job. And Susie will be the first to admit that. In fact, she's always thanking my mother for the way she raised me, because she says, "You gave me, you gave me the best gift."
Yeah, but do you think Desi moms are more, as you said, more disciplined in terms of, kids' education?
100%. Sometimes to a fault. But in contrast to Arab moms, they feel even more. In contrast to just, parents who are on top of their game, they're not. They're just parents who are on top of their game. And Arab parents are, let's face it, mostly, I don't know, it's a blanket statement. I know many Arab parents who are on top of their game too. So
they're more relaxed.
They are more relaxed. There is a certain guilt, but, having lived in New York for a dozen years, it's no different than Jewish guilt.
Hmm.
It's the same. Jewish moms are no different than Desi moms. They're like, you never call, you never write. So all that, the Desi guilt stuff that we get, it's no different than Jewish guilt.
And not just that. I think it's also the way we want our kids to learn. I think that the learning process, education itself, like I see having these conversations with my daughters, and I just push them more than sometimes I feel guilty about doing that all the time. But then my immigrant mentality kicks in, because for me, it's important that my kids do well in America, because that's why my husband and I are here.
You're here because you competed and you ran the race and you came through. So it is a competition. And we Desis have a sense of competition that we channel into hard work.
Right.
Arabs have a sense of competition that they channel into their egos. Now, I'm not saying Pakistanis or Desis don't have egos. If you look at our political system, it's entirely egos. So it's just a matter of channeling into hard work, and that's how we define success. The thing with Desi parenting, and the thing I don't like about it, is that we define success by money, and we define success by how successful you are in life based on how many homes you own, and notice I said plural with homes,
yeah.
Because then my son has a house here and a house there and an apartment in Manhattan.
But do you think it's more
I
to do with...
I don't have any of those, just to be clear.
Don't you think it has to do with immigrant mentalities? Because I feel like people, native-borns, are more relaxed. They are more...
They don't have anything to prove. Their parents have done all the proving for them. And that's where we have to push. Because they still have to prove, they still have to, run the race in this world.
Saqib, let's talk about your work. Your project, Space Mosque, combines mysticism with sci-fi. Why did you decide to combine these two very disparate fields? I am not a big fan of sci-fi, but the idea of, you know, mosque, like Sufism or mysticism combining with sci-fi was so intriguing. Mm. And I've seen the sculpture or that you have created, and it's amazing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I've created a number of sculptures around it. But before getting into that, just let's talk about the concept of it or the theme of it. I don't think they're that far apart. They are connected. They both search for the eternal. A lot of science fiction, if you look back at, you know, early science fiction of Star Trek, they were all voyages to go where no man has gone before. And in spirituality, we've always searched for the unknown, the divine, and we've always looked towards the stars for that, because that's where the heavens are, or that's, you know, that's where the Almighty lives or is present. Or, and if you look at Greek mythology, or if you look at any different religion, they've always looked towards the stars. So I think there's a connection of science fiction and spirituality that way. There's also a connection of, I like to work in this area of Sufism and science fiction. And I think there's a connection there as well, because Sufism is, a lot of it is about self-actualization. And in order to get self-actualization, you have to be self-realized, and you have to look inside yourself, and you have to find love within yourself. And when you find love within yourself, you go out and you seek love in the form of God, right? So God, if God is love in Sufism, which God is, then how do you find God? By practicing love. And you do that with others, you do that with yourself, and more importantly, you don't treat God or look at God as a punitive God. You look at God as not even a he or a she, but as the all-knowing entity to love. That was just the connection between science fiction and Sufism, or and spirituality in general. But the idea of Space Mosque was really sort of bore out of this question that I read this quote once, if all your prayers were answered, would it change the world or just yours? And that started this idea of Space Mosque, where like, wow, what? Built it around this narrative of this parafictional global phenomenon that happened in the near past, where due to the arrival of this mysterious spaceship from the future, every human being in the planet got one prayer answered every 24 hours. And during that time, that phenomenon, good things happened and bad things happened. And one of the things that happened was that, you know, everybody started praying for money. And so when everybody prays for money, what happens? The inflation happens. The whole world erupted. Everything in the grocery stores were, you know, it cost thousands and thousands of dollars. So the global currency changed, and it no longer was about money, but prayer became the de facto global currency during that time. And this is a fictional narrative I've created. I call it parafiction because it's made to look real. And I talk about it as though it was real. And so at that point, greed and morality were at constant war. Because if everyone's praying for themselves, who's praying for others?
Others. Why did you choose that narrative? Why did you choose the narrative that everybody will pray for money?
That's a study of human nature. That's just greed. That's what we would do.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of people would. To start off with, so I kind of have it all broken down. I'm working on it right now as a structured story and everything. So there's different times during which of the phenomenon and what happened. Initially, a lot of people prayed for money, and that totally disrupted the global economy. But then things settled down and people started praying for other things beyond that. But then people also discovered that children's prayers were accepted and being received with a much higher rate of return than adult prayers, because there's a sense of intention and purity that children have that adults don't, because our prayers are infused with ego and, you know, jealousy and things like that.
This is such an interesting concept. When I think about prayer, to me, it's realization of one's limitations as human. Because for me, it's a very humbling experience because as a human, I feel like I'm recognizing the fact that I cannot do everything on my own. And there is this, as you said, divine being, he or she.
You're talking about submission.
Submission, right? And I just ask or seek his help. But it's very interesting how you bring in greed into this. And that is another perspective that I never thought about, especially with prayer, because to me, it's so selfless. The act of praying is so selfless.
Well, it's submission followed by requests, because in prayer, you also ask God for things. And the dua portion of the prayer, right?
So where you're bargaining,
where you're asking for stuff, and you've got a Christmas list that you're going through in your head, like God, give me this, God, give me this, God, give me this, God, give me this, right? So in that sense, you are asking the Almighty for something in return for your submission. It's a bargain. It's a deal. It's another thing I love about Sufism. It doesn't have that. There's no bargaining in deals
there's
selflessness. There's love. So that doesn't exist. There's no reward system where if you do good, you know, you get to heaven. You do bad, you don't. That kind of thing. So don't really believe in that. But greed really came into play in the narrative. And so when people discovered that children's prayers were being answered more and more, this gave rise. Some corporations saw this. And this gave rise to the prayer farms. Corporations started partnering with orphanages and started recruiting children from around the world and started creating these corporate prayer farms. And the corporate prayer farms then were the mechanism through which people's prayers who weren't being answered because of their bad intentions, not all prayers were answered, only prayers with good intentions were answered still. So they could use this as a channel. So politicians, other religions, you know, people who needed to get something done would do it through this way. So that completely changed the system of the world. And so hence greed and morality were at constant war.
So it could be made into a TV show or a book.
I'm actually working on that right now.
Great. Yeah. So we will see it hopefully soon.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm in the thick of it right now. Writing stories and thinking of this world deeper. I've already been working on it for a couple of years now, but there's so much more to go. So, yeah.
So this is a good segue into another project that you did somewhere in America. And it's an exciting project where you use transliteration of Jay-Z's song. And you basically replace Quranic verses with it to point out, in your view, flaw. And in reading, in practicing religion the way we practice religion right now, especially for Muslims, because they read Quran in an alien language, which is Arabic. Not all Muslims are Arabs. And I agree with you there. But it got me thinking about something else. And here's my theory. For a believer, it is about divinity in word. Right. So the idea of preserving Quran in its original form and having it as reference was one of the intended consequences of why it was preserved in Arabic. Now, so when I was growing up, I tried to read it in Arabic. I couldn't. My father reads it in English. So language itself or sanctity of language was never something that I thought about.
That's great. You're very lucky.
Yeah, probably. Although I was told later that I committed a sin by not doing that.
Exactly.
But the unintended consequence of all of this is that Arabs and the language itself, Arabic, have become de facto custodians or representatives of Islam.
Yeah.
And that's what bothers me a lot. And even to this day, somehow Saudi Arabia is the representation.
So
it is so annoying. Do you think this project, first of all, what was the response like to this project? And what were you trying to get from it? And were you able to achieve whatever your goal was?
Yeah, so this project was also a collaboration that I did with another New York-based artist, Kinza Najm. Her and I both went through the same experience. Like, yeah, you know, we're made to read the Quran as kids. Huh. Gotta read it. And so we did and finished it. Yay, party. And then there's literally a party afterwards.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. And Quran Khatam party, done. But the child has no idea what he or she has read, nothing. And most people don't, but they'll quote it. Those who actually read a translation in Urdu, in English, in whatever language, you know, good for them. Because that's what they're supposed to do.
But honestly, even if when I read it in English, it is so metaphorical. It's like reading Shakespeare. I don't understand what I'm reading.
The Quran is the most abstract work ever.
Exactly. So unless you have like explanation for every verse that you're reading, you cannot understand what you're reading. And that's why sometimes it's confounding to see.
And you can't take it literally.
Literally, you cannot take it literally. And there are so many non-Muslims quoting Quran and saying, oh, so Quran says to kill infidels. And I'm like, as a Muslim, I can't understand it. How do you get to understand it?
I mean, you can't even. It's as abstract as, like, if you look at Jackson Pollock, it's no different. You know, it's like, well, anybody could have painted that, or anybody could have thrown, or you have to understand context and you have to read the book with context. You can't just take a quote out and say, kill the infidels, because it's connected to a bunch of other things. And that's not what it's saying.
But it's unfortunate that Islamophobes and fundamentalists both do the same thing.
Of course.
They are so similar in so many ways.
So that's what the work is about, because it's this miseducation of blind faith that it's commenting on. And being an American, I've seen how there's a sense of, I guess in a way, a new gospel being formed, you know, that has formed culturally. And that's the gospel of hip-hop. And the gospel of hip-hop is revered in a big way. And so I wanted to make that comparison. And so I was listening to Jay-Z's album at the time, and this sort of contrast just struck that, this might as well be Greek. Like, what we're reading in the Quran might as well be Greek.
Exactly.
So let's replace the old gospel with the new gospel with Jay-Z lyrics. And the lyrics are also commenting about the state of affairs in America as well. So it's about the state of affairs here, but also about the state of affairs of the miseducation of blind faith.
Did you, in fact, show it in Pakistan as well?
It's never been shown in Pakistan. It's been showed in there's a collector who owns it, who owns an edition of it in the UAE. And there's also a prominent journalist and Professor Sultan Sud al-Qasimi, who was giving a talk, and in the talk he showed a slide with this image on it. And that's how the collector saw it and then reached out to us and acquired the piece. But he showed it in a talk as an example of the miseducation of blind faith. So I think people resonate with it, especially people who have been made to read the Quran without understanding it.
Was there any backlash?
No, not at all. And there shouldn't be.
There shouldn't be.
There's not a single word on there that is of the Quran. The only Quranic reference there is the visual. It just looks like thick old manuscript, and it's got the ornamentation of a Quran. But the letters are simply transliterated Arabic letters.
And that's what artists are supposed to do. And I think one of the drawbacks of how Muslims are practicing their religion right now, the current state of affairs, is that we don't question our religion anymore. And we don't let our artists do their, you know, creative expression of what how they see religion or culture. And that's such an important exercise.
We're afraid. And you should be able to question certain things. I'm not go as far as, you know, drawing doodles of the Prophet Muhammad, but you can explore. You're allowed to explore. We're human, and artists, our job is to explore and question, and not necessarily to give you answers, but to question and instill questions in your mind.
You know, you've done so many interesting projects, because as I was doing research, I came across so many things that I wanted to talk about. And it seems it's all about your projects, but there are so many interesting, and I want to bring up another one, Hawa Sandals.
Yay.
Oh my God, that's one of my favorites, because you've created this winged version of Peshawari Pakistani Chapel.
Yes.
It's rendition of Peshawari Chapel. And it's expensive, by the way, because I was trying to, I looked up
not
online.
Not for art, they're not.
Yeah, you're right.
They're only 100 in the world.
Are they like light? Because when I see them in pictures, I can't figure out if they are light enough for me to wear and walk.
Oh, God, yeah.
They are.
They have a sneaker sole. They're as light as sneakers.
But they are so beautiful.
Thank you.
And they're gender neutral, right?
They are. Yes, they absolutely are. And they're a beautiful creation that I'm very proud of, that Marjor and I worked on together. And those guys are amazing. They are a handcrafted shoe company based in Pakistan. And I partnered with them. The idea for the sandal first was part of the Space Mosque project. And the story behind the sandal starts with a story of a 12-year-old boy during the time of the phenomenon who lived in Peshawar, Pakistan, whose parents were separated. And the boy prayed to spend more time with his estranged father who lived in the town of Kohat. And so he prayed to spend more time with his father. And the next morning when he woke up, his Shaori chapels had grown wings. And so he would go and see his father every day after school and then come and fly back home. And when the vessel left, the sandals stopped working. But at the Space Moss show that I had earlier this year at Icon Gallery, there's sculptural versions of these sandals. And they have much larger wings. Those aren't really wearables. But I made those with Marjor, and my experience with them was so fantastic. And the story of Wakas and Sidra, the couple who founded Marjor and then later Adams, which I'm wearing as well, by the way, I just loved it so much that we just developed this connection, this immediate bond of friendship. And we started talking about the idea of a limited edition, smaller winged version that were wearables. And they make a sneaker chappal, which is so comfortable. They basically took the rubber tire sole that exists on all Peshawari chappals and swapped it out with a foam sneaker sole. And that immediately makes the chappal much lighter and much more comfortable.
Yeah, because Peshawari chappal, my father used to wear it. He still wears it.
Yeah,
my brother
so
growing up wore it. And it is not the most comfortable chappal.
You have to break them in.
You have to, right?
Yeah, but the Hawa sandals it's different.
It's very different.
They don't take much breaking in. I wore mine the first day, and I walked 9,000 steps in Manhattan.
Wow.
And I had a small blister towards the end of the day, but that's normal after breaking in any shoe. But they're just so comfortable to walk in, and the wings make them look even lighter. They don't feel lighter, but it's not a heavy shoe at all. So it's handcrafted leather with this sneaker sole, and they come in white and tan, and there's 100 of each.
And are you planning to add any more colors?
There are plans of doing another color in the summer, yes.
Is it a tribute to your ethnic identity? Because Peshawari chappal is so quintessential Pathan thing.
Yeah.
But somehow there's so much pride in it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, now, you know, people globally can wear these chappals that we, like our parents, like, have been wearing for so long. And by the way, who is your audience? Because you've done so many different projects, and every project has some cultural context to it. Who are you trying to connect with?
People who live in both my homes. So people of New York or America or the world, and people of South Asian origin, people of Middle Eastern origin, people of any origin who are empathetic with the idea of being an outsider and having felt what that feels like.
You were recently in Pakistan. Yeah. I follow you on Instagram, and you were posting such interesting stories. And it's interesting because when I was growing up in Pakistan, the only few places I would be in was one was Lahore, where I grew up. And then every summer and winter, we would go back to our village to celebrate Eid and stuff. Right. And that was that's the extent of geography of Pakistan that I understand, which is a sad thing. But you captured it so beautifully. You were in Karachi, and then you were in your village, and you were in Islamabad. How was that experience like? Can you talk a little bit about your travel to Pakistan this time?
This trip, yes. Yeah. So this trip was a very special. We were just there in November, so about a month ago. And the same artist I was talking about earlier, Kinza Najm, her and I did the Somewhere in America piece.
By the way, I just interviewed her recently.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, she's a great artist.
Yeah. So her and I did this collaborative, interactive installation, sculptural installation. I guess it's technically an installation. It's a seesaw with a double-sided stainless steel mirrored wall in between them with a little opening in between. And when children ride the seesaw through the opening, they can see each other. But when adults ride it, we just see a reflection of ourselves. And so the work is called Don't Grow Up. It's a trap, and it's a permanent, well, Kinza's probably already told you, but it's a permanent installation at the Karachi Zoo Park. And it was part of the Karachi Biennale that happened it's November 2019 just now. And it was a phenomenal experience. I usually don't go to Karachi when I go to Pakistan. Like yourself, I go to Islamabad, Rawalpindi, I go to Lahore for art stuff. And then I go to my village in Babri Banda outside of Kohat. But that's still like, you know, that's a whole region of Pakistan that I go and visit. Lahore is a completely different world. And then Karachi is a completely different world as well. I have so many friends from Karachi, and I'm so connected to Karachi in that way. But I've only been a handful of times in my life.
Same here, just
so
once or twice.
It was like going to a new city, but because I know a lot of the artists and a lot of those people through art and Instagram, it was so amazing meeting a lot of them for the first time. So, but I felt very welcomed and just felt very much a part of it. In that sense, it was great. It makes me want to do more things in Pakistan. And then afterwards, going to my ancestral village, Babri Banda, Pakistan, which is completely different than Karachi. And it's a completely different world. And, you know, you literally change your clothes.
Exactly.
And you change the way you are, not inside, but just on some of the mannerisms and just, you know, there are norms within that culture. And I love the norms of that culture. There are also my norms too.
Yeah.
So I love going there and spending time in the village and spending time with, you know, everybody in the village and all of that. That's also important. I'm an only son. So for me, the connection to the village is very important.
And you were also showing Hujra. And again, my parents' village, there is a Hujra. I'm so used to all of those terms, but you have to have context for it. Did you get any questions about, you know, Hujra and all that you were showing?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I was posting a fair amount in my Instagram stories, and people were asking questions. All right, so what's this place here? What's going on? And then, of course, I have some of my friends like, oh, so is that where you guys hang out and plan the bomb attacks? So no, but I would be explaining it to people and things, and so I probably had, I'm not kidding, about a dozen people who wanted to come visit Pakistan with me after those after those stories. Really?
Because people here are scared to visit Pakistan.
They don't
unfortunately
know.
They don't know.
They don't know.
They
don't know that the bomb attacks, the bomb planning doesn't happen at the Hujra.
Yeah.
It happens in the room behind, around the corner.
There's another photo series that I want to talk to you about before we wrap up, and it's called A Suitable Girl. It's a satirical take on this like quintessential girl that every mother and son wants.
Yeah. This is a Tariq Amin idea.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Tariq Amin is Pakistan's probably one of the most prominent, probably the most prominent hair and makeup artist. Well, like, there's like, you know, a handful. He's definitely up there, and he's been around for... Yeah.
I used to go to him for a haircut. And this was like, I don't know why I would spend so much money as a college student and do that, yeah, but I did that.
He's like probably the most prominent, right?
Yeah, in Islamabad, at least.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a household name. So I was at a party with him one evening, and he's like, I'm so sick and tired of all these women coming up and saying, Mujhe Kim Kardashian banado. He's like, make me look like Kim Kardashian. He's like, I swear, I want to just do a photograph.
Even Kim Kardashian is not Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
She's evolved and transformed over years, right?
She is. So he had this idea. He says, I really want to do a photo of my salon. And instead of, you know, a bride sitting there, I just want to have a blow-up doll sitting there.
Huh.
And I was like, that's a great idea. That should be like, you know, you should do that. He's like, no, I can't.
Yeah.
Because I'm Tariq Amin. I can't do that. I said, do you mind if we do that? And he's like, yep, please. By all means, go ahead and do something with it. So I left right after that, and I called Ginza. I'm like, hey, what do you think? And she was like, yes, let's do it. So then we explored that idea further, and Ginza connected with that idea as well. She herself was a suitable girl. And so she found a connection with it too. So the two of us worked on it together, and we created these series of photographs with this amazing photographer, Morgan Miller, here in New York. And we shot these scenes and scenarios with this blow-up doll bride and the whole idea of, you know, she's this suitable girl, perfect for the South Asian home where she'll be taking care of her in-laws and her husband, but at the same time looking like Kim Kardashian, and like all these pressures that they see parents put onto their daughters that is unnecessary.
And it's unfortunate how pervasive this notion is, even in India and Bangladesh.
Sure.
And it's like the entire like subcontinent. But do you think...
We give them difficult names and difficult burdens.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should just leave them with difficult names and this stuff right
there. Yeah, just like Palvasha and that's it.
Yeah.
But do you think it's being like too harsh to judge society by its worst traits?
As artists, it's our job to show a mirror.
Hmm. How would you describe a suitable girl, though, for audience to understand what does that mean?
Oh, in its traditional context.
Not my idea of a suitable girl. Not your idea.
Okay. My idea of a suitable girl is Susie Afridi. But a suitable girl is a well-educated girl who has full college degree, master's degree, doctorate maybe, but she cannot work as doctor. She must be housewife. And all right, I'll stop the accent. And so... My son does it, and he does it terribly. And so she has to be highly educated, but will not use her degree in any way. She must come from a certain dowry, or she must come from a certain type of family. And then the expectations of her are to serve. Yeah. And almost in a geisha-like manner, you know, and then to worship her in-laws and the ground that her husband works on. And I think, you know, this is also, we're subcontinental. So, you know, we get a lot of this from Indian culture as well. And it's just something that we've been raised with for generations.
Do you think it's changing, though? Do you see a change among...
Did I capture a suitable girl, though?
Yeah,
did I miss anything?
You did.
What did
age,
I miss?
Age. She cannot be past...
You're right.
Like 22.
23. Yeah.
Like, if she goes beyond that, she's
That's
already
it.
Downhill.
You're done.
Yeah.
You're done. Yeah. Yeah. You're past your prime.
And it's... So
but I think our audience will relate to that as well, right? I mean, that's so different than I am. So I hear 27, 28-year-old girls, like... struggling with that themselves. They're like, oh my God, I'm 30. I haven't found somebody I haven't found the one. All my friends are getting married. So like, this is a normal thing. I kind of hear it,
and it's different for guys. It's completely different.
But there's that's a whole other conversation. But yes, completely different. But this idea of pressure from the parents is the difference between how a 28-year-old here feels versus a 28-year-old in Pakistan. There's a much harder pressure because she's getting it from everybody, down to the guy at the store who says, who literally, a lady at the store will ask you, are you married? In Pakistan,
everybody is in everybody else's business. That's common. People can ask me questions. Like when my daughters go to Pakistan, our family asks them really crazy stuff. And they are shocked.
Right.
And then my husband is, no, this is just part of our culture. It's okay. And sometimes I'm like, no, it's
not. So that's the burden
okay.
of a suitable girl.
Yeah, but and it starts early on. It starts at like, what, 17, 18?
Yeah, I would say earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. My sister was told, I think, at about 13 or 14, you know, that, yeah, when nothing, but yeah, just not told anything bad. It's like, you know, when you get married, you know, it'll be like this, it'll be like that. And like the dream of the wedding and what your role as a woman needs to be starts, I think, at probably 13, 14, you know.
And it is such an integral part of who we are as a society and how we define women. Wedding and marriage and family, it's like we don't talk about other issues as much.
It's changing. There are many strong women out there right now who are changing this, and I love it.
And I think it probably because now I see like women in my family who are in their late 20s and not yet married, like 10 years ago or even 15 years ago, that would have been a taboo, like not having been, like not getting married until 27 or 28 or even...
Or not getting divorced.
Or getting divorced.
Yeah.
Although in my household, it was so different.
Or just being single and having a career and choosing to do that.
Choosing
to not have kids and just...
Yeah.
And to live your life. I think more and more women are doing that now.
Yeah, but when I see Pakistani TV, I feel like everything is the same. Is it like, are we regressing in terms of our media outlets and depiction of who we are as a society?
No, I think I think Pakistan is becoming more and more woke every day.
Hmm.
Yeah, I like to think that it's becoming more woke, that younger people are waking up to it, are realizing it, are calling it out, and this is where social media is great.
Yeah.
They're calling out people's shit. Like we if you follow Mango Boz or anything, you know, you see it every day. There's always some guy who was caught on camera trying to tease a girl or do something or say something inappropriate and all that stuff. And they're being called out left, right, and center. And it's not just a global thing. The Me Too movement really kind of woke the world up.
Yeah.
And so I think it is. And we see it now in rural Pakistan. It's very hard.
Although I would think that people in rural Pakistan and in like upper class in Pakistan are more emancipated. It's our middle class that bears the burden of transmitting these traditions and facing all the restrictions. Yeah, I think when I see women in my village, I feel like they are a lot more emancipated than I ever was.
Yeah, that's true. They're doing man's work.
Yeah.
You know, they really are. Yeah. Especially in Punjab.
In Punjab, yeah.
There's I see that a lot in Punjab as well. Less in KPK.
Probably,
for sure.
Yeah.
Because of just the culture.
So before we wrap up, where can we find your walk and your hawa chappals, sandals?
You can find my work on my website, saxafridi.com, or on my Instagram, @sax__. And you can find a link to the Hawa Sandals there as well. But you can also go to the Marhor website, where you can acquire the chappals yourself. I think it's marhor.com/hawasandals. Or if you just go to the site and you go into the chappals section, you'll definitely see it there. And you can learn about the story and the narrative of the chappals and all of that.
And before we end the interview, if you were to describe America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
They're my jeans. They fit perfectly.
Hmm. No complaints.
I can complain about any place or any... I choose not to complain.
Hmm. Thank you, Sax. This was wonderful. I had so much fun, and I'm glad we were able to do this finally.
Me too. I'm still thinking about that last question.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, there's... I'm going to stick with my answer.
Okay.
this was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes.